This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Morning, everybody. How are we? Who here cycles to work? Who here cycles to the shops? Who here cycles the kids to and from? So put your hands up if you cycle. Put your hands up if you've never been on a bike ever before and seeing this have just decided you're never going to do it at all. Well, there's potential here. Tim Moore has written eight titles now, largely about cycling. He spent a lot of time in the saddle. His latest book, which he'll be signing off the event, is called The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, which is about a crazy journey he took, tracing the line of what we of a certain age will understand as being the Iron Curtain. So first of all, would you give a very warm welcome to Tim Moore? Thank you. And we shall start with the obvious question, why cycle the Iron Curtain? Where did the idea come from, given all this cycling that you have done, from Frosty Mastache to Geronimo, following the Giro d'Italia, all sorts of other stuff, why the Iron Curtain?
That's a very good question, Paul. Well, I suppose I am, as you say, a man of a certain age, and the first half of my life, really, was had the kind of shadow of the possibility of imminent nuclear destruction over it, which was a formative experience, I guess. And then in 1990, just after the wall came down, I kind of went off on a drive around the various areas behind it in this sort of clapped-out old Saab, and it was a very compelling experience, and it's still... Even 25 years after that, it still seemed, because I am the age I am, it still seemed like it's kind of forbidden territory. Like, you know, they're the sort of, you know, the evil empire over there almost. And it's
all those formative years in the 70s of government warnings of using brown masking tape to cover
absolutely.
Your and whitewash to cover your windows in case of nuclear
hide
attack.
Hide under the stairs and then get under the kitchen table and
exactly.
And twiddling around on. I had this shortwave radio and listened to kind of Soviet jamming signals and all these sort of fruity voice defectors like Lord Haw-Haw types and stuff like that. It was
exactly.
Yeah.
So the decision was, let's go and see what it's like now. How much of the Iron Curtain remains? What of it's visible? Mm. But of course, as with any curtain, there are two ends. You decided to start at which end?
Well, obviously, logically, in terms of the fact that it starts at the very, very top of, well, there's a tiny bit of Norway, but then the entirety of...
So north,
Finland.
It's even off the map up here.
So it is. And it ends up in Bulgaria, down in the Black Sea. So it would have been a really good idea to have started at the nice warm end and then gone up to the top end in summer. But there's two reasons why I didn't do that. One, slightly embarrassingly, because that's kind of uphill, isn't it, really? So I want to get down.
There is the sense that going north is uphill.
It really. I mean, I know it's ridiculous, but nonetheless, that was a primary motive for not doing it that way. And also, no offence to Finland, but Finland's not terribly interesting. I thought, do I want the glorious narrative arc of my achievement to end with 1,500 kilometres of me on my own in a sort of prone landscape of pine trees and lakes? So I thought, to make Finland interesting, I'll go there in winter.
Right.
So I went in winter, and I made it even more interesting by doing it on this representatively communist-era shopping bicycle from an East German firm called Miefer. And they made 3 million of these, actually, amazingly, in East Germany. And it was really designed for going down to your, communist-era camp shop, I suppose. So you go out of your tent and go down to the shop and come back with a loaf of bread and two bottles of beer, and that would be it.
They were made where?
In a place called Sangerhausen in East Germany. In fact,
right.
I've just discovered yesterday that the company's just gone bankrupt after all this time. Can you believe it? I went there, took the bike back there to meet its makers. They weren't quite as excited as I was by this, although actually it was slightly hurtful because the managing director turned up and there was a local photographer turned up and he was pushing this other bike. Like a new bike, and he said, "Oh yes." So we shook hands, and he said, "Now you will take this new Miefer on, continue with your journey." And I think he genuinely thought I only had this bike because I couldn't afford a better bike. I paid 55 euros for this, so it was kind of awkward. I said, "No, that's really not the point. But thank you very much." But I continued. But
how sweet they actually offered you one of their new models,
exactly.
Then. And how sad that they're now bankrupt. They've just got the most fantastic piece of publicity in the world.
I would doubt that.
So you 55 euros for the bike, and you bought it from where?
Well, it came. I got it. Well, it was actually slightly. I decided I'd go to drive to Germany to pick it up.
Right.
And had an incident which involved me destroying my car on the Autobahn, so came back without it and then paid somebody slightly more than 55 euros to deliver it in a van to my house. I did actually, I have to say, I made some alteration. This bike has had no gears at all. It now has two gears. And I did change the saddle and I put a crossbar on it because it didn't have a crossbar because most of these bikes were folding bikes. And when I got in touch with these East German bike collectors on the internet, where you find these people, they said, why are you attempting this thing? It will become a horror show. I had such a bicycle as a small boy, and it would fold in half at the hinge. And they're sort of made out of kind of melted down coat hangers or something. So I had this little thing installed here. And I found somebody. I can't believe. Why would any responsible tyre manufacturer make studded snow tyres for a 20-inch wheel shopping bike? Anyway, I found somebody who did, and it's not wearing them now because obviously it's not snowing. But I had it was absolutely ridiculous. It looked like kind of the sort of thing like, I don't know, Mad Max's auntie would have driven down to the bingo. This tiny little bike with this really aggressive. I mean, they're petrified. When I was putting them on, I kind of cut my hands to shreds.
Right. Mm. Nasty. So you started in Finland. Give us an idea. In winter, what was the temperature day one?
Well, I thought, even though it was a really irresponsibly stupid thing to do, I thought if I start in March, somehow I thought it wouldn't be that bad. And I spent an awful long time looking at the weather data for this very part. It was called Kirkenes, the tiny town where I was starting. And it seemed like winter had ended. And there was a little sort of webcam outside the police station in Kirkenes. And as March approached, I watched this big patch of snow on this mini roundabout sort of shriveling away to nothing. I thought, perfect. And then 2 days before I was going, I refreshed this webcam and it was just a total whiteout.
Good Lord.
So when I arrived there, there was like this much snow. And it was, I think one day it was minus 22 degrees in the morning. And so, I did take an awful lot of clothing. And I had about 18 layers and these gigantic kind of insulated Wellington boots on the out and sort of ski clothes. So that really enhanced the ridiculousness of my outfit. I mean, I dwarfed the bike. It was just ridiculous, really.
How did you carry stuff? It doesn't look like sort of much of a load-bearing bicycle, I have to say. Did you have panniers? Did you have a trailer?
I had two panniers here, and right. I had a team of huskies. No, I didn't have that. two panniers, and I wore everything. I mean, I just at that stage, I was wearing everything that I had,
Other kit did you take? Did you take any sort of water bottles, camping kit? In case of emergency, medical kit.
I did take a water bottle. That would have been really remiss. Although it was always a bit. I took a water bottle, but clearly, I had been warned that would last about 4 minutes before it froze solid.
Yes, quite.
So I had one of these little sort of pouchy camelback things.
A camelback, yep.
And that was a really good tip. Someone said, "Well, fill it up with really hot water in the morning, and then it'll keep you warm, and then it won't freeze."
Brilliant.
And it kind of worked a bit, but then the entire mouth of tubey bit completely froze. As indeed did my outermost anorak thing, which was really alarming. So I started along on day one. I thought, my something happened to my arms. Oh God, I've lost it. And the whole thing had just frozen. So I could have literally just taken it off and stood it up in the snow beside me. it was deeply alarming. And it's just so remote up there. I mean, there would be in the north of Finland. There's just nothing there.
So a lot of it's not like you're cycling from village to village. You're setting off from a settlement during the day one. And the next people you see maybe 3 or 4 days away?
Well, the next, there would be like 70 miles sometimes in between houses. So
right.
I would have to, luckily there was this woman who basically saved my life on about 14 occasions. She was the president of the Finnish Cycling Federation.
Right.
And someone put me in touch with her I think they were just hoping that she would talk me out of it. And she did try very hard to talk me out of it.
Right.
But then when I wasn't talked out of it, she said, well, here is my number. If you were in trouble, you will give me a call. And the good thing about Finland, because they kind of invented the mobile phone sort of, like Nokia and stuff. So anywhere you are, in the middle of nowhere, you always nearly always have a phone signal. And I did think, thanks very much, Raya, but I probably won't. I'm just going to go. But of course, on the very first day, I was, oh God, where am I going to stay? I'm completely lost. And I phoned her up, and I don't know how she managed to do it, but she would just phone me back 10 minutes later and say, it's okay, just keep riding, and I'd keep riding through this completely desolate, snowbound nothingness. And then after about half an hour, some guy in a big fur hat would just blunder out of the woods and flag me down, and he wouldn't speak any English, and he'd just follow, and I go and sleep in his reindeer farm, or like, you know, once it was a decommissioned bank in this tiny village and things like that. So I was completely dependent on the kindness of strangers.
The joy of adventure travelling. We're often very dependent on the kindness of complete strangers. What were you expecting to see, given all the imagery that we grew up in the 70s, of the Iron Curtain, of it being other, of there being sort of gun turrets and barbed wire and all that sort of stuff? What were you hoping to see physically?
I was physically hoping to see a lot of gun turrets and barbed wire. Right. It's because that's just, you know, I wanted to see, you know, the young Michael Caine being bundled into the boot of a Wartburg and driven away over the snow. And actually, there is quite a lot of that kind of stuff still around. I mean, some of it has been preserved as a sort of warning from history.
Right.
And in particularly, in between, when I was going down the bit in between what, you know, the old east-west German border, they preserved great big lengths of Berlin Wall, and it is. It's very, very humbling and quite... Well, it was awkward as well, because I kept on taking selfies of myself in front of iconic bits of you know, barbed wire and tank traps and stuff. And the first time I discovered one evening that my camera phone had a voice-activated shutter, which is quite an exciting feature. But I'm not quite familiar. There were three words that said like three words activated. I don't know. Anyway, the first one was whiskey. The other ones were shoot and capture. So it was a very windy day when I was first tapping this feature. But by a bit of the, and there were a few old ladies walking their dogs in the old bit where they had the kind of Alsatians barking.
Okay.
And I put my camera on top of this sort of tank trap, and I'm standing next to the Berlin Wall. Like, shoot! Shoot! Capture! Right. that was not a good moment. But you could even actually, it was really interesting to tell, because it does, you know, if I talk to my kids about it, they want, you know, 1989, Dad, like, what's that? Like, they don't have no understanding of what it was like. And it is a long time ago, but still, even when there weren't preserved bits of the Berlin Wall, you could always tell when you'd crossed over what had been the border. I mean, partly because quite often in East Germany they still have loads of cobbles, which was an instant rider, but also actually people's attitudes. And people were much friendlier when you crossed over into what would have been the Old East. And I was quite surprised by that. And then I realised actually a lot of these older people, for the 20, 30, 40 years of their lives, they wouldn't have seen any strangers. So when somebody new comes to town, it's like, hey, there's a different person. And so that was quite sweet, actually. So I enjoyed that.
As you headed further south, out of Finland, and started to talk to more people, did you get a sense of people who had been there while the Iron Curtain was there, while the wall was up, effectively, and how they view this era, post the Iron Curtain, but also at a time of rationing East-West tensions as Putin gains more and more power?
Well, yes. No, it was... and I think in particularly in some of all the Baltic nations, it's all a very... It's a very confused picture. And I got some... I mean, I came out of Russia. I did a little bit in Russia, which was... It was dreadful. And it is... I've realised over the years that no matter how much you want nations not to live up to their least flattering national stereotypes, they just do, always. And Russians were just, you know, not very friendly, a bit hostile, and it was and always behind the wheel of their lorries having drunk 18 bottles of vodka. It was absolutely terrifying.
Right.
So I came into Estonia and I saw the little, you know, the EU flag at the border, and I did. I burst into tears of relief and went straight into the first guest house, and I said, I'm just so happy to not to be in Russia. And she said, well, that's good for you, but I am Russian. Here we are all Russian. and, you know, and so I realised it's so sort of blurred in lots of these areas. And they do have, like, very, very large ethnic Russian populations. And you won't find anyone saying, you know, Putin is fantastic. But a lot of people are Putin, you know, sympathisers in a way. And so you have to kind of be careful in terms of the questions you ask them. But it was... I came across this place in Latvia. There was entire massive areas, the Baltic coast, were just... basically fenced off during the Soviet era, not marked on any maps and stuff, and now they're open, but they still haven't been sort of reclaimed by man in a way. So I would just come up and say, what's that? And there'd be this gigantic, you know, satellite dish thing, like a sort of covered in sort of weeds, and I read off as it was the largest radio telescope in Europe. Cool. And there was this enormous town, like this sort of KGB town built all around it, which is now all decayed, and you could go in and there were like all these copies of Pravda in this old reception area. It was absolutely extraordinary.
You could get in and walk around.
Yes, I just wandered in there, and it was and then when I got to the town, the next town down, and I was really excited. I was telling the guy at this motel place, I said, oh, this And he said, oh, you went in there? I said, yeah, it was amazing. He said, oh, because we had some trouble there, and there was a man looking after, like a caretaker, and he was murdered last month. It was like, okay then.
That must be weird, though, walking through an old Cold War sort of part of the cutting edge of Soviet defence systems.
Yeah, no, it was, and they're really interesting. The guy said, they had four dishes there, and when they were asked to leave in the end, they destroyed three of them, and they said, it's too big for us to destroy, so we've just disabled it.
Right.
And then a couple of years ago, a team of amateur astronomers said, what a waste, this massive kind of dish that we could be looking at asteroids or something. And they went in and discovered it had been disabled in a very, very systematic way,
right,
which they were, you know, with some difficulty, nonetheless able to undo. So clearly it hadn't actually really been, it had been kind of, don't want to waste that, we might need that. So I think the Soviets had obviously had an eye on kind of coming back and
we're going to mothball it in a systematic way, but we might need to use it again in the future. How extraordinary. With any long distance journey, you know, there are days of extreme joy when you're doing the very thing you set out to do, and it's been a good day, and the weather's been bright, and the people have been kind of stuff. And then days of abject misery, not least in Finland, from the sounds of it. How do you cope? I mean, any endurance journey is about mind as much as about body. How do you cope when your snowsuit is frozen, you're being run over by moose or drunken Soviet 18-wheel truck drivers? How do you keep your head right and just keep pedalling on?
You don't, actually. I think I'm permanently scarred by this experience in some ways. My wife did say, she actually came out at one point in the middle of Finland. She just turned up and said, I've talked to you on the phone, and I think you're losing your mind.
Oh, really? She was that worried she flew out to meet you?
Yeah, and I didn't realise how bad I was losing my mind until I came home, because I, instead of writing notes, which obviously was a bit difficult while I was wearing about 18 pairs of gloves, I was making recordings on my phone, which I, of course, had to activate the touchscreen by swiping it with my nose, which is the only bare bit of skin available, and when I listen to some of these things, you can actually hear me going mad. I'm starting to repeat myself within the space of about 5 seconds.
Good God.
I'm just sort of mumbling and kind of like singing and stuff. So it is. I think maybe I might be a slight bit of hypothermia possibly kicking in. I don't know. But you're right, it is. It's mainly, it's physically just, actually on this bike, because you're going so slowly and because actually large parts of this route were pan flat, it's not actually physically that difficult, but mentally it was just beyond belief. And I had this laminated map of the route, which I put on an A4 bit of paper, and I took a little marker pen. I thought, I'll just, you know, fill in, at the end of the day, I'll just fill in the bit that I've done. And after 3 weeks, I could literally just barely make a sort of dot on this map. I thought, I'm never, ever, ever going to finish this. And I can only assume in the end you just settle into the proverbial one day at a time, and you don't think about the bigger picture. You just think about, okay, I'm going to start here, like, where am I going to be able to stay, and I'll just get this 100 kilometres done, and then you know, not suddenly, actually, really in a very terrible drawn-out process, when you get to places like Germany that feels sort of vaguely familiar, and then there are places where you can meet more people and shop and actually buy food without having to kind of stuff it into your pockets, hoping it's going to last you for the next 4 days, it becomes easier. But just the and towards the end, I mean, it's been... As you know, you've done these things yourself. It's all you've done for such a long amount that you just think, I can't possibly readapt to normal society ever again. This has just become what I do.
It takes a while.
It took me about 2 days, actually. But at the time, I thought this is never going to happen.
I was talking to somebody yesterday who said, I can't remember who it was. It might have been Charlie Bowman, said that he was doing, when he was doing a long way round with Ewan McGregor, they kept bumping into cyclists, you know, that were flying Welsh flags or Cornish flags or Scottish flags in the middle of nowhere, Mongolia or the Russian steppes. They'd say, where are you cycling? They'd say, well, we set off from Swansea and we're heading for Hong Kong. And you suddenly think, these people, you know, they went on a day trip and it ended up being a 7-year expedition, and they just kept on going because they didn't know how to stop. So,
that's it. And that's, for my purposes, it was really demoralising. It was the only other English-speaking people I met, apart from my own family when they came out to spend a couple of days with me, were this New Zealand couple that I met in Serbia. So by this stage, I'm kind of in the home straight and feeling very pleased with myself. And they were on bikes. They were cycle tourists. And they said, so where did you start? And I said, well, actually, I started right up at the top of the Iron Curtain up in Norway there. And they went, all right, yeah, well, we started in Spain. We're just going to the Great Wall of China.
Good heavens.
Like, oh. That was crushing. And they were camping as well. And they sort of said, we had a snake in our tent last night and stuff. Because, I mean, I didn't have to say, someone had said, you shouldn't obviously do camping. That's the authentic thing to do. And I thought, well, at my stage of the game, I want a reward at the end of the day of cycling for like 11 hours on this stupid bike. And that does not involve putting up a tent in a snowdrift. So I'm not at home to Mr. Camping.
How far did you plan ahead where you were going to? Did you plan ahead sort of where you were going to end up each day and check for, knew there was going to be accommodation, that sort of stuff? I mean, in terms of logistics and planning, how comprehensively did you approach that?
Very misleadingly professional gloss on the entire endeavour. But yes, I did, generally speaking, apart from in Finland when it was just off into the void every morning and then pathetically phoning this cycling federation woman who was hundreds of miles away. She was literally nowhere near where I was. But yes, I mean, you would, that's what you do in the evenings. You look at the, you get the maps out and you think, okay, well, tomorrow I've got to, and you want to try and do, always use kilometres because they always just much better for your morale.
It's a much bigger number than miles. 1.6 kilometres to a mile, and it really counts.
And you do get fixated, as I'm sure you do when you do any of these long, on the sort of the data and the statistics and how many miles you do a day. And all I wanted, which didn't seem too much to ask, was 100 kilometres a day and an average speed of 16 kilometres an hour, better known as 10 miles an hour.
Right.
But please don't let me finish this doing under. And I failed on both counts. Really close. Well, I did about 99.4 a day, and it was like 9.98 miles an hour. The last few days, I was killing myself trying to get it out.
Yeah. Oh. But it's those targets that keep us going. Mm. So you were cycling for 10 hours a day, on average.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I did. Also, I only ever really took. I took 2 days off. I got some friends of mine who. One of them lives in Berlin, so I stopped in Berlin for like two days. But other than that, I cycled every single day. It just seems, and I regretted actually stopping for those 2 days, because actually when you stop, that's when you start to think, like, what am I doing? It's ridiculous.
And then you have to start again.
Yes. It's only once you just stay in this weird zone of blotting out everything else about the rest of your life and what else might be going on in the world. And
I don't know if you're aware. Do you know Will Self? And he used to write a thing about called psychogeography. The psychology of sense of space and location. Can you tell us anything about the sort of sense of psychogeography of the Iron Curtain now, as it varies from the sort of northern hemisphere as you get further down to not southern hemisphere, but to southern Europe and to Bulgaria, how that changes?
Well, it's
in the mindset of different nations.
Yes, I mean, it's in Finland. It was difficult to say because I didn't really see anyone. I met about 10 people the entire time.
Right.
But when you get further south, I mean, you know, I think it's just more of a southern European thing. People tend to be, you know, a bit warmer and a bit more curious. I mean, having a bike is a brilliant introduction because everyone just, particularly a sort of silly bike like this.
Quite.
So people come up and talk to you and. You know, why on earth are you here on this funny... Well, actually, in fact, in Serbia, this is the default bike in Serbia, I discovered.
This is the what?
The default bike is a 20-inch wheel Soviet
era. Still?
Yeah, so they would just say, like... No one said, like, oh, my God, said, oh. In fact, going into Romania, the border guard said, like, said, well, so you come from... And I said, I'd point on the map. He said, oh, that is bicycle normalno, like a normal bicycle.
Right,
like,
okay.
That's about as high praise you're ever going to find. But yeah, I mean, you know, the shadow of the bad old days, as it were, is much, much more obvious in certain countries than it is. I mean, you know, Serbia was, I suppose, the place where I thought, just because even though it wasn't really officially part of the sort of Soviet bloc, because it still has more of that vibe and has a sort of slightly, you know, dodgy reputation and the, you know, pariah state thing going on. But maybe partly because of that, but the people there were just incredibly friendly and approachable. And that was because I always like to come home thinking, where was the, you know, what was your recommendation? So like Serbia, is the undiscovered jewel? Well, I mean, it certainly appears to be when you're on a sort of shopping bike, and many everything's really cheap as well. So it's,
did you notice different nationalities treat cyclists differently? I know cycling through France, they tend to give you lots of leeway, and in Spain they give you even more leeway and they're very kind. Whereas here you get the sense, in Britain, you get the sense that everybody's trying to murder you as an act of will. Did that vary across the length of your route?
Very much so. I mean, in Russia, as I've discussed, they were, I don't think it was necessarily malice, they just like, were too pissed to notice that you were there.
Right.
But in Germany, for instance, there's so many, they have such an incredible network of bike paths.
Yeah.
So when you're out in the sort of countryside, you are never ever on an actual road. You always have your own separate path, which like wanders in a dilatory scenic route over the hills and down dales. So on the occasions when you, there are little tiny bits, so you do have to go onto a road, the drivers are completely freaked out. Oh my God, and they will just sit behind you for like 10 miles waiting for like a 15 mile stretch of open road so they can creep past really apologetically.
Good heavens.
Extraordinary. And yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there were lots of places when I came into places like Romania, they don't really have any, again, no bikes there, so they tend to sort of not know how to treat you, which
right.
can be good, but sometimes is not at all good. I didn't actually get, thinking about it, it's extraordinary when I look at some of the places I went through and how bad the roads were and how wobbly my bike was, but I didn't really have too many near misses. That the worst thing actually was all the dogs in Romania. Lots of dogs.
Right, yes,
and,
of course.
I can't outrun a dog, as I've discovered on this bike. So that.
No,
was,
I think you probably have trouble outrunning a dog on that.
Yeah, I did have two. When I was in Berlin, I bought these two cans of this pepper spray.
Right.
Which, I don't know, I'm not quite sure whether in Romanians make a habit of threatening dogs with pepper spray, but somehow I've just the sight of this, you know, well shaken can 2 inches from their face was enough to have them turn you. I never actually had to use it in anger. Tempting as it was.
Tempting as it was, yes, exactly, yeah. Or even on border guards. Tell us about mechanics. How were you prepped for punctures? Did you have puncture-proof tyres? Did you have any mechanical failures that jeopardised the trip?
I had quite a lot of mechanical failures, but actually, weirdly, bear in mind, as I've described, the background of this bike and how it was designed to travel about 10 miles in its entire life, all the things that went wrong were things that I had done to try and make the bike better. So I changed the cranky things here because it had cotter pins, and I've done a previous journey with a stupid old bike which involved cotter pins, which almost destroyed my life.
Right.
So I thought I'm not going to have that. So I got a different bottom bracket thing, but because I'm an idiot, I didn't put it on properly. So after about 3 days in Finland, it started to kind of loosen itself.
Oh.
And then there's this sort of square pin thing,
yep.
which became not very square, and then started to spin uselessly around. That sort of thing. So I had to. When my wife came out, she kindly bought. She'd read about my plight on Twitter and bought out a new crank, which is very good of her.
Fantastic.
I had one puncture. I can't remember. I had one puncture in 9,000 kilometres, and that was in Finland on deep snow, which again doesn't really make any sense to me. I think it's just because I was essentially just going really slowly. I think most punctures happen when you're kind of going anywhere.
When you're going faster, you can't avoid stuff. Yes, exactly.
It's only got one brake actually at the front, this thing. This was the luxury model. I should have pointed this out earlier. Like 90% of these bikes were the basic MIFA 900 series had a brake which kind of fell out of favour in the penny farthing era, as far as I'm aware, which pressed a metal rod through the top of the mudguard and depressed a sort of pad on top of your tyre.
Yes.
So I had this luxury model with a single caliper brake at the front here, but again, I didn't even use that a single set of brake pads, despite topping the fastest speed I've ever been on a bicycle down the mountains in between Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic and Germany somewhere. I went, I think it was 69 kilometres an hour. Yeah, I don't think I've ever...
69 kilometres an hour down a mountain?
It was 60-something, yeah.
Good God.
Yeah. I know, extraordinary.
It's terrifying.
It was terrifying, but... The back wheel, something's wrong with the bearings there. So the back wheel has an awful lot of lateral play in it, like a lot. You can have a go later on, you can just all cycle it around the...
Feel free to come and cycle it around the... Yes, exactly.
50p a go.
So as you get closer to the end of this journey and you're cycling across Bulgaria, which is beautiful countryside, what's going through your mind? You're obviously starting to revise and think, OK, well, I've done it, 9,000 kilometres, three and a half months, I've forgotten how long you took now.
It was almost exactly 3 months.
Yeah. 3 months?
Yeah.
You're coming to the end of something. There's always that sense of sadness that it's over. There's also the sense of huge relief that it's over. And then there's the, now I've got to write about it. How, as the writer part of you, do you approach writing and telling the story of the journey that you've done?
Yeah, well, this one was actually a bit more... I think I was out of my normal sort of comfort zone of, like, an underprepared idiot does something overambitious and struggles miserably. So I had to kind of find a... kind of apposite and interesting pithy ways to insert the entire not very funny, in fact rather miserable, doom-laden, murderous history of the Soviet Empire into this whole story. So that was tricky in terms of, and also there comes a point when I've done 3 books about cycling,
right,
and you start to worry, have I said all there is to say about unfit middle-aged man cycling up Big Hill on inappropriate bike? So Sometimes I do think, have I said exactly this thing before? So I have to have both of the other previous cycling books, sorry about this, everyone, open as Word files, and I have to get a... I've said that exact same thing, so I find...
You actually do that? You word search.
I'd rather that than somebody comes on Twitter and with like a little screen grab saying like, "Oh, look at this!" in these two separate books. That would be
Tim Moore has cut and pasted a whole chapter from a previous book.
Yeah, so that's a challenge. But in terms of the putting the whole journey into context, it was when you come home, you think, how can I possibly condense this? You know, because every day, sometimes at the end of a day, I'd look back to the morning and think, I can't, you know, there's so much stuff seems to have happened in one day, and I've got, 100 days or 90 days worth of stuff to condense. How can I do that? So in the end, you have to just leave out an awful lot of stuff and avoid the trap of saying, and then I woke up in the morning, and then I cycled in, I had lunch there, and then I finished,
Yeah. Well, one thing you're brilliant at writing is a very good narrative that sucks us in. We'll go to questions from the floor in a second. One last question from me. What can we expect from you in the future? Because I'm slightly disturbed to hear that it may not involve a bicycle for once.
No, there's some more wheels involved than that. So, last June, I set off to drive all the way across the United States of America, going through all of the counties with the highest Donald Trump vote, driving a 1924 Model T Ford.
East to west or west to east?
East to west.
East to west.
Not uphill or downhill, in fact, so what was that about? Yeah. So that again, I don't know why. These things always take me 3 months. That was 3 months.
Right.
And 6,000 miles, and I had an awful lot of near-death experiences in that, I can say.
More in a Model T Ford than on a two-wheel bike.
And none of them involved kind of angry kind of pitchfork wielding mobs of Republicans or anything. It was just the car falling to pieces around my ears and in a century old metal fatigue kind of way.
We should look forward to reading that. What colour was your Model T Ford?
You'll never guess. It was black. Although actually the guy in Texas who owned it before me had it for 51 years. He was the same age as the car. He was born in 1924, which is very sweet. And at some point, I think in a sort of midlife crisis, probably in about 1968, he put all these slightly psychedelic little coach lines in, and he painted the wheels purple.
Super.
That was quite a sight.
Another stood out in Republican counties. Your turn to ask your own questions of Tim and cycling and the Iron Curtain and Finland and anything else you want to ask. We have a roving microphone. We'll start with the gentleman there, please.
Hi, have you still got the Hirondelle 7 from Geronimo?
Hold on one second, we're going to turn your microphone up. Can we have it a little louder?
Have you got the Hirondelle 7 from Geronimo still with the wooden wheels?
I've still got all the bikes I've used, actually. They're all annoying my wife in their shed-based dominating presence. But yeah, it's still there. I don't ride that one very much because it is 100 years old and it does have wooden wheels and it's the brakes are actually even worse than on this bike. So, but it's still, I'll never get rid of them. I mean, even this ridiculous bike here, I've got one of these sort of secure gold massive D-locks and an extra chain. I locked it up outside here and the security guard was like, "What are you doing?" It's a sentimental value, mate. What can I say?
For those that haven't read Geronimo, just give us the heads up of what you wrote about in Geronimo.
About 5 years ago, I set off to do the entire route of what I discovered was the most appalling race in the history of Grand Tour cycle racing, which was the 1914 Tour of Italy. So I thought, well, I know, I'll do that route. I think, yes, 91 people started, 8 people finished it. No. So I'll do that route, and I'll do it on a 1914 bike, wearing 1914 cycling clothes. Perfect. Which is a great big, huge woolen fisherman's jersey and other summer inappropriate clothing. Yeah.
It's a very good read if you fancy reading about another man's misery on two wheels. Another question, please. So many of you and no questions. How can that possibly
be?
Yes, please, sir. Mm.
Can I just ask you how much it cost on your expedition through Russia and how do you finance that?
I can give you a very, very detailed costing because on the entire journey I averaged, I think it was 80 euros a day. That was for everything.
80 or 18?
80, sadly. 80 would have been better. But,
okay.
Yeah, no, so it's... and I financed it through the miracle of getting somebody else to pay me money to write the book, which was a very, very handy way of getting these things done. Yeah, that's how they go. But it doesn't really... I mean, I think I think the whole thing... So was it for 18... it cost me about 3,000 quid, and that was including the flying there and coming back, so it wasn't actually that bad, really, yeah.
Food, accommodation, flights there and back, kit.
Yep.
All of that.
Food is not very expensive, I can say. So.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true. Answer your question? Sir.
Hi. So I had a long argument with my flatmate the other day about specific rules regarding cycling on pavements in this country. Are there any extraordinary laws or regulations that you came about with cycling in the former Soviet states and in Russia? Are there weird little bylaws that you encountered?
Well, I mean, apart from, all motorists must take great efforts to mow down cyclists. I did discover, actually, on my last day in Finland, having spent almost 3 weeks in Finland doing, like, 79 kilometres, and I came to... For the last 2 days, I was actually in areas with real people and traffic and towns and so on, and the cyclist pulled up a set of lights, and he said, you're not wearing a helmet. And I said, no, because I had a sort of huge snood and a massive fur hat and everything else. That's why I couldn't really fit it on. He said, but it's the law here in Finland. I said, well, I said, you've only got about 12 cars in the whole of Finland. Come on, give me a break, man. But, almost certainly. I probably broke about 18,000 different traffic regulations in these countries. But that's the good thing about being on a bike like this. They take you so unseriously. They're never, ever going to sort of pull you over. And I did actually, at one point I was in Germany, because they were very diligent little local speed limits. You could go through the towns. I mean, it literally is like 15 kilometres an hour. And I did take a few pictures of me breaking the speed limit, one of those little flashy up sign things, you know, your speed is... No. That was good.
Don't tweet those, they'll be after you.
Yeah.
Isn't it some incredibly futile law? It's either Sweden or Norway, or possibly Finland, that you have to, if there's a moose on the road, you have to give way to the moose. And the law is so futile because why would you not give way to a moose? They're enormous and weigh 400 kilos.
Well, I found the best thing. You just leap up onto their backs and
get them to tow you.
Yes, to Bulgaria.
Exactly. That would be very interesting. Do we have any more questions? If not, we should... Oh, yes, please. Maybe have the microphone here at the front, please. Thank you.
In which countries did you find the most physical remnants of the Iron Curtain?
Well, Latvia, definitely. An awful lot there. Germany kind of doesn't count because, like I say, they preserve most of it as a sort of deliberate history lesson. I guess a lot of the border areas where there were lots of people used to go, lots of East Germans went to Bulgaria to escape. And they were actually, gunned down in the woods without anyone noticing because the Bulgarian border guards were secretly paid a bounty for each escaper they found. So in a sort of grim way, I was always like expecting to see some sort of, femurs sticking out of the roadside. Sorry, that was really a terrible thing to say. So the Latvian, well, particularly Latvia and Germany and so on. Yeah, but they're still actually surprisingly large. I mean, you can see because the border was that they deforested a huge section around it to kind of the death zone or whatever. And you can, and the, even though the wall's gone and all the fences are gone, there's still the completely different, low, slightly paler green, wide stripe that's about 30 foot below the tree line, just going over the hillsides, and you can see it almost all the time. It's, amazing.
Any more questions? Yep, gentleman here. Sorry, with Mr. Microphone Man. Thank you very much indeed.
I mean, you mentioned that, there's the green space and that type of thing. Were there any areas where it was a little less certain where the Iron Curtain actually went and you had to do research to find out exactly where it went through?
Yes, actually, in fact, because there's this route which I was supposedly following called EV13. There's the European Cycling Federation has set up all of these Eurovelo routes, and this was their newest one, which is why I originally heard about it. And when I got in touch with them, I said, well, they had a sort of little thing on their website with a line on a map. And I said, I'll follow this. I had it in mind it was actually going to be like a nice marked cycle path for the entire distance. I think it was about 2,000 miles before I saw my first sign suggesting I was actually anywhere near whatever EV13 might have been. So a lot of the time I was just making it up as I went along. So sometimes, there was certain things like, am I on which side of the border might I be on? And then you'd see, there were still the bits of, sometimes you go through the woods and there'd be like a load of tank traps sticking out the side of the road, or big lumps of concrete which obviously military aspect, or these roads that they used to put, these kind of access roads with these concrete slabs and things like that. I said to the European Cycling Federation, I said, well, how far is it? Because there seems to be some variation. They said, well, actually, we don't know, so could you tell us when you finish? Because no one's done it yet.
You're kidding. They had no idea.
No. Well, they had a range of about 800 kilometres either way they weren't sure about.
There's a fantastic tweet, a photo of a tweet, where Tim says, there's an ongoing power struggle to determine the route of EV13. As ever, the endurance shopping cyclist is the loser. And basically, the wheels are this thick, and the mud on them is that thick. Have a look here. It's page... can't even see read the page now. Page 161 on the book, when you go get them.
It's worth it just for that picture alone. Honestly.
It is worth it for that picture alone, exactly. Is there any place that you pass through because you have to click off a certain number of miles a day if you're ever going to get the right route done? Were there any points that you went through you thought, actually, I'd quite like to spend more time here. I like this place. Do you have any... How many hankerings to go back to?
In the evenings when you're wandering around, particularly like in places like Serbia, which felt a bit of a sort of undiscovered jewel. I'd walk around these lovely old, Habsburg era squares, and it was just me and the locals, and everyone's having nice ice creams in the sunny evenings, and there were beautiful old houses arranged around this sort of piazza type things. And I think, what a lovely place to just hang out.
Just to be.
But you have to guard against the holiday tendency, as I thought of it. Because like never, as soon as you start to feel you're on holiday, then it's just all over, isn't it? You've got to.
Why so?
You lose the sort of the mission-based mentality.
It's easier to have that second coffee than to get on the bike.
I am hopelessly ill-disciplined in my general life. And this is, I think I get it all out of my system in one go in these things.
Right.
I mean, for 2 years, I sit around picking my nose, like staring at a computer screen, doing absolutely nothing, and then just go away and do far too much. It's a really very unhealthily binary existence.
But it works for you, and it produces some good books. Tim will be signing over in the Stanford's tent over there. They've got the full range of his books. If you haven't read Frost on My Moustache, which is sort of where you started...
It is. Thank you for not explaining the punchline for the joke there.
Can I recommend that to you? If you want to hear about riding the 1940s Giro d'Italia in appalling conditions, that's the book for you, in a book called Geronimo. But The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold is a very fine work. Just one last question. What is the importance of a snood when you're undertaking a mission like this?
It's the snood. I couldn't have done it without the snood. If there was a snood marketing board, I'd be signed up as their snotty-faced poster boy straight away. So, as well as keeping your entire face warm, it's a useful facial wiping device when you start to. I'm sorry, but it is. So it's multi-purpose.
On that happy note, enjoy the rest of Destination. See you at the next show. See you later on. Thank you for coming, and thank you to this wonderful man, Tim Moore.
Thank you.